This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Imagine building something as ambitious as the Panama Canal using late 19th and early 20th century technology. Difficult doesn't begin to describe the challenge, but doing so was Teddy Roosevelt's audacious pet project, and one that succeeded in creating one of the seven wonders of the modern world. The canal is celebrating its 100th birthday this year, and the Mint Museum is observing the centennial with an exhibit, The Panama Canal, Then and Now, which opens on Saturday. This is happening just as Charlotte may start to benefit mightily from an expansion of the canal. That expansion will allow substantially larger ships to pass from the Pacific to the Atlantic, bringing more cargo to Wilmington and Charleston to be shipped by rail for distribution to the rest of the country using our city's new intermodal transportation facility at Charlotte Douglas International Airport. So, this hour, we look at the history of the Panama Canal, take a peek at the Mint's exhibit, and explore the future of the canal as a conduit of trade between the Americas. We're joined by Dr. Jonathan Stuhlman, Senior Curator of American, Modern, and Contemporary Art at the Museum. He's the fellow that put this exhibit together. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Danny Martin is a founding member and head curator of the Nederland Mining Museum in Colorado. Among their acquisitions is one of the steam shovels used to widen the canal shortly after it opened. It's a piece of which is on loan to the Mint for this exhibit. And interestingly enough, Mr. Martin is one of the few people in the world who knows how to operate an antique steam shovel.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'll ask you why you know how to do that a little bit later on, perhaps. And we're also fortunate to welcome Jonathan Farrar, the United States Ambassador to the Republic of Panama. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Morning. Thank you for having me.
I understand the timing of this exhibit at the Mint because it coincides with the 100th anniversary of the opening of the Panama Canal on August the 15th in 1914. But why Charlotte? Why the Mint?
Well, it started with the painting, actually, as it had to, being that we're an art museum, that I came to know about 12 years ago. And was never really aware of any American imagery of the canal, and was visiting with a private collector, and he'd just gotten the painting back from having its frame regilded, and he said, "Do you want to see it?" And so I got down the floor, we were unboxing it, and it's a big painting, it's about 4.5 feet wide. And we unboxed it, and it was face down, and I remember we turned it over, and I was just stunned by seeing this beautiful American Impressionist style painting that depicted the construction of one of the locks of the canal, and just became fascinated by it, and at that point in time requested it for loan at the museum that I worked at. I thought it would be great to share it with our audience, and just started digging into the painting, and realized that the artist had done a whole series and was one of the few American artists that had actually gone down during the final few years of the canal's construction to work on site. He, Alston Skinner Clark, and two others, Jonas Lee and Joseph Pinnell, all went down and worked in Panama and just had this kernel of an exhibition idea in my head to bring together some of these paintings and explore it. Fast forward a few years to my time in Charlotte, and I'd continued to admire the painting and asked the owner if he would lend it to the Mint when we opened our new building uptown here about 4 years ago. And so it's been on view there, and realized a couple years back that Centennial was coming up, and kind of started planning to do this small focus exhibition. And as we learned more about Charlotte and its many global connections and its ties to the canal and through the things like the intermodal hub, the exhibition kind of took on a new life, and we began to expand it, and it grew.
Was it difficult, because you can't have an exhibit of one painting, was it difficult to find? I think there are 50 other paintings in this. Was it difficult to find them, and what was the criteria?
Sure. So we really, at first, it was tracking down works by Joseph Pinnell, who did a discrete series of prints of the canal, and they were drawn from a book that he'd published. He was the first of the three to go down in 1912. And the book was so wildly popular when he came back and published it, it went into five editions by the time the canal opened 2 years later. So it was easy to find series of those prints that were made from the images that were in the book. They were kind of distributed widely, and so we gathered together a good number of those. Work by the two other artists, Jonas Lee and Alston Skinner Clark, we tracked down through previous exhibition catalogs and research in the field. and we're able to find all of the Clarks actually come from private collections. Huh. Some of the Lees have been disseminated into museums, and so the big painting by him that we have is from the Detroit Institute of Arts. But the works of art in the exhibition come from all over the country.
So would you say these works of art are more artistically significant, or are they historically significant, or are they a combination of the two?
I love that combination is what I think makes them so compelling, is that they bring together kind of the work by three of the top American artists at the time, who all, I think, very ambitiously went down. They felt this was going to be their kind of one of the turning points of their careers, to go down and document this undertaking, which was very popular in the press. I mean, there's so many stereoscopic images and newspaper articles and things about the canal and its construction. I think it's hard for us to think today what a big deal this was while it was being built.
Well, if I understand this correctly, three out of four people who worked on the construction of the canal from the time the French began in the 1880s through the early part of the American effort to build this canal, three out of four of them died from yellow fever or malaria or accidents while they were building the actual canal. But the artists, the photographers, were equally susceptible to yellow fever and malaria.
Yeah, but by the time that they had, that was one of the kind of triumphs of the American efforts there, was around the time that we started working down there. Dr. William Crawford Gorgas was a doctor who helped to kind of figure out the mosquito link and was able to successfully eradicate, for a large part, illnesses due to malaria and yellow fever. And actually, he was the focus. We commissioned a short story to accompany the exhibition, and that was what the author, Anthony Doerr, chose to write about. He wrote a beautiful fictionalized biography of Gorgas's life. Mm. And so he actually plays a little bit of a role in the exhibition.
So do most of the paintings in the exhibit, did the artists actually go to Panama, set up an easel and watch?
All three went down and primarily went down and sketched on site and would go back. You know, Pinnell would sketch and then come back and make prints from his sketches. The others would make small studies and then make larger easel paintings.
Once the canal opened, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, it put us on the international stage, and people were collecting all kinds of. They were playing cards with photographs of the canal being constructed on them, and people. There was a great interest among the populace for this. But before it opened, I would think that not so much. I mean, maybe people were curious about it. What made these artists curious enough to risk their lives, essentially, to go down there and do this?
I think by the last few years of its construction, it had really become a tourist destination. Thousands of people went down. You can see in one of the paintings, the paintings were done in 1913 and 14, and you can see in one of them, you kind of look down the top of one of the locks, and there's a workman coming up towards you. All the figures on top of the lock are tourists, and they have, it's women with white dresses and parasols. And so I think by the last few years of the construction, it had just become such a popular tourist destination that it was pretty safe to go.
And you couldn't even take a cruise yet through the canals.
It was all railway.
Ambassador Jonathan Farrar is with us. He's the U.S. ambassador to the Republic of Panama. The building of this canal on the part of the United States was not one of our shining moments, diplomatically speaking. As I understand it, the French started this canal in the 1880s. They abandoned their work in 1894. We gained control of the canal zone with something akin to a war on Colombia. Can you talk about that? Do you want to talk about that?
Well, the U.S. acquired the rights over what was the canal zone through the Hay-Bonavarria Treaty, which came about after Panama's separation from Colombia. That's right.
Well, we're glossing over a key issue here, and that is the fact that they separated from Panama, separated from Colombia, much with our help, because we blockaded the Colombian troop ships on both the Atlantic and Pacific coasts of the Isthmus of Panama so that Colombia could not go in and prevent the Panamanian separatists from separating. And we almost instantly recognized the government of Panama because we wanted the canal zone, right? Am I glossing over this too much, or is that true?
I think it's hard to recreate alternative history, but it's probably true that it delayed the response of the Colombian troops. That's true.
Well, Teddy Roosevelt famously stated, "I took the isthmus, started the canal, and then left Congress not to debate the canal, but to debate me." and the recent series by Ken Burns on PBS that dealt with both the Roosevelts, that really was his modus operandi. I'm going to do what I want to do, and I don't care what you think. It's actually very refreshing. but how did this...
Thank goodness I don't have to get into domestic politics.
Yes, exactly. How was this viewed? How was this move on the part of the United States to blockade Colombian troop ships to prevent them from stopping the separation movement in Panama? How was that viewed by our fellow countries in Central America and South America? And as a diplomat, how would you deal with that today?
I think we're in a bit of a different era today.
You think?
but I think if you come to Panama, you will see that there's an incredible affinity between Panamanians and Americans to this day. And I think Panama is probably one of the countries most welcoming of Americans, whether it's private citizens or U.S. companies, U.S. products. There's truly a warm relationship there. Mm.
But this was gunboat diplomacy. I don't mean to dwell on the past and some of our past transgressions here, but this was gunboat diplomacy. And maybe it resulted in certainly friendship with the Panamanians. What about Colombia?
Mm-hmm. I think today, if you look at the relationship between the U.S. and Colombia, it's one of the closest we have in the hemisphere. So it shows how relationships can evolve over time.
Well, is it partly because we were successful in building the canal, which, not to use it, it's a tired cliche, it raises all boats. I mean, it kind of does, doesn't it? I mean, the economic prospects of Panama were exponentially amplified by the opening of that canal, right? And probably much of Central America.
Yeah, that's undoubtedly true. And, you know, there was also a short-term attempt by the United States to do a widening of the canal right before the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And today, during the ongoing expansion of the canal, they actually used part of that excavation to get a head start on it.
Yeah. We took possession of the canal zone, built the canal, operated the canal, and remained in control of the canal zone until 1977. What led to us relinquishing that canal? Was it pressure on the part of the Panamanians? Was it simply a unilateral decision by President Carter, who took a lot of political heat for this? What was the reason we gave it up?
Well, I think there was clearly a long process of negotiation between the United States and Panama that led to the Carter-Torrijos treaties. And what that was signed in 1977 and ratified in 79, but what it led to was a 20-year phase-in whereby the U.S. gradually turned over the elements of the canal zone to the Panamanians. So actually, the full turnover took place at the end of December 1999.
Okay, so it took a while, even though the big news hit in 77, and people were pretty upset. We'll talk about that perhaps a little bit later on if we have time. But evidently, we had a really good relationship, and the Panamanians seemed happy with our control of the canal until shortly after World War II. What happened? Do you know what happened that kind of changed their attitude and led to this push toward taking control themselves?
Well, I think it was probably a natural evolution following the Second World War. Panamanians wanted to recover sovereignty over this zone that was in the middle of the country.
Just natural progression of attitudes and change, I suppose. We'll talk about the Panama Canal at 100 in advance of a Mint Museum exhibit that opens on Saturday. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Pottery Festival, featuring over 100 potters from the Carolinas and other regions, November 8th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the LeGrand Center in Shelby, North Carolina. Information at carolinapotteryfestival.org. And Mr. Rogers Windows, a local family business since 1986, offering renewal by Anderson replacement windows and entry door systems installed by trained craftsmen. Product details at mrrogerswindows.com. Bread has been one of the world's most important foods, but in recent years, our obsession with carbohydrates has caused bread to fall on hard times. It's also pushed bread bakers to experiment with new formulas using different kinds of ingredients and grains and things like that. And one of those experimenters is our own chef on assignment from Johnson & Wales University, Master Baker Peter Reinhardt. He and others will be here tomorrow at 9 to talk about the bread revolution.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a new study says bike traffic deaths have spiked after years of decline as cities adapt to growing numbers of cyclists. Some say traffic laws should be more strictly enforced. Debate over sharing the road with bikes.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Panama Canal at 100, Connecting the World. That's the name of the exhibit that opens on Saturday at the Mint Museum Uptown. And it runs from Saturday through February the 1st. It consists of, I think, 50 paintings that were painted during the construction of the Panama Canal, and a very special artifact, which we're going to talk about in a second, that is on loan to the Mint from the Netherlands Mining Museum. Danny Martin is here with us from that museum. He's the head curator there and a founding member. Jonathan Farrar is U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Panama. He's in town for the opening of that exhibit and another event that we're going to be talking about. And Dr. Jonathan Stuhlman is Senior Curator of American Modern and Contemporary Art at the Mint and the person who put together this exhibit. If you have memories, perhaps you've been to the Panama Canal or perhaps one of your distant ancestors participated in the construction of the canal. If you have memories of that or questions of our guest, you can tweet them to us at WFAE. You can also email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Shirley in Union Grove emails, "My father was in the Army Corps of Engineers and my family lived in the canal zone in 1952 and 53. Even though I was very young at the time, I still have wonderful memories of Panama as well as movies my father took of ships going through the canal. He wanted us to understand how the locks worked. One of the movies he took included a visit from the newly crowned Queen Elizabeth. The Panama Canal is an amazing feat of engineering that everyone should see. I hope to be able to make a return trip before I'm too old." You're there every day of your diplomatic life, so why should we all go down there and see this thing? It is a marvel of engineering.
Because your listener is right. I've probably taken that tour of the canal, the Miraflores locks, 12, 15 times. And when you walk across the gates of the locks, you're walking across the very gates that were built 100 years ago, and they're still in use today. And then you get to the control room, and you see the control table that the Army Corps of Engineers constructed 100 years ago, and that was in use from then until 2007.
Wow. No computers.
When they put the computers in 2007. And you think about the foresight of some of these engineers who were able to construct that. And it's truly a marvel.
You know, this is not the time for this conversation, but it's looking back on things like that. The United States built this canal, which the French had tried, which others had attempted and dreamed about for half a century, which was then and remains a marvel of engineering, and we overcame tremendous difficulties to build this thing. Why can't we do that today? We don't seem to be able to do those things today. We outsource them to private companies so rockets blow up on the launch pad. Why can't we do this today? Nobody can talk about it. Certainly the ambassador's not going to talk about it. I just want to throw it out there. Ambassador Farrar, the canal was deemed worthwhile because it would shorten and make less hazardous these trips that ships had to make, a 9,000-mile trip around the southern tip of South America up to the East Coast and vice versa. And success would certainly – the success in building this shortcut through the Isthmus of Panama would certainly be beneficial to business, to consumers, to the economy. J.P. Morgan and Company was involved in the actual transaction of paying for the canal, but the money came from the Treasury. $40 million, I believe, came from the United States Treasury to build this. Was that a popular decision? Because this is a major infrastructure project, and $40 million in 19, whenever we began this, 1902, 1910, whenever we began it, that was a lot more than $40 million is today.
That was real money.
That was real money. Yeah. So was it a popular decision? Was it difficult? Or did Teddy Roosevelt just jam this through and do it?
I think Teddy Roosevelt took the initiative, and it was probably not wildly popular until the canal was actually constructed, and people could see that truly it was going to be a success. Mm.
This was one of the most difficult engineering projects ever undertaken. And Danny Martin, this is right up your alley, because I'm told that among the things that you're interested in, aside from running that museum out in Colorado, is you love old equipment, old mining equipment. Where did that come from? Where did that interest in you come from?
I think that truly came from my father's genes in our family. We're sort of all entrepreneurs, and we all have this wonderful mechanical ability to be able to fix things. I can remember being 3 years old, getting a screwdriver and going down to my great-grandmother's car and taking off her license plates and bringing them to her. And from that point on, I was always interested in anything that had to do with machinery, anything that was mechanical. And as the years went on, when I was younger, I started to repair things, whether it was a lawnmower or a car or a dirt bike. I always had this fascination for equipment. It's sort of an understanding that I have with mechanical equipment. It's hard to express that in words, but I just have a fascination for anything that's mechanical.
You helped your town and your museum to acquire this steam shovel, which we'll talk about. Give me the official name of this steam shovel.
It is a 1923 Bucyrus 50B steam shovel that was used down at the Panama Canal to widen it after the opening of the Panama Canal.
Was it like the steam shovels that were used to actually construct the canal?
No, all those original shovels were what's called railroad shovels. And what that meant is that the shovels had to travel on railroad tracks. And they were limited in the way they dug, where they can only swing 180 degrees. So they can only sort of dig in front of them and to the sides and dump to the sides as well.
If you're on a railroad car and you dig in front, you're taking the track out.
Yeah. Well, they can only build the tracks basically to the front of the shovel, and so the what they call the face of the rock is where they could dig in front of them.
The French tried to do this and couldn't. Maybe it's because the technology hadn't.
That's correct.
Is that what it was?
Yes. One of their main reasons they failed is that their equipment was insufficient for this type of digging. It was very light duty. And it was just tearing the machines to shreds, basically, is what was happening. And this is prior to the use of steam shovels. They were invented, but they did not come truly into vogue until the early 1900s, where these machines now were considered very heavy duty and can deal with that type of rock.
This steam shovel that you acquired, and part of which is on display at the Mint, which we'll talk about, was built, as you said, in 1923. What makes this different from a modern mechanical shovel, aside from the fact that it's powered by steam?
It's powered by steam. Everything is mechanically operated, and it is also cable operated versus hydraulics, modern hydraulics. This shovel was the first of its kind to be put on crawler tracks. As we know today, we see them on...
Like tank tracks.
Yes, that's correct, or bulldozers. Mm-hmm. And it was the first shovel that could revolve 360 degrees and dig from any point, and it can travel at any angle it wanted to sort of progress as it dug and dumped.
Hmm. The French were trying to build a canal that went along the isthmus at sea level, and that required a lot of digging because evidently there's an elevation at some point in Panama, and they were unsuccessful. And there was an argument in this country about whether to continue to try to dig a sea level lane or to use locks. We chose, evidently, to use locks. And I would think that building locks without the use of computers and with the technology available to us in the early 1900s was incredibly difficult, was it?
That's correct, yeah. I actually read an article last night in a publication from 1910 where a mining engineer was going to develop a machine to actually do a sea level canal. Mm-hmm. And he pitched this idea of building this basically sea-to-sea type of canal. And amazingly, I personally don't think that would work. And a lock idea, thank goodness, you know, they took that on.
How big are these locks? These are essentially doors that open and close to allow water to come in and raise the level of a ship. How big are the doors?
They're huge. And they're not all the same size, because the ones that are on the facing the Pacific Ocean, because of the tremendous tides down at Panama close to the equator, those are much bigger and heavier than the ones that are further inland.
What powers them? What powered them in 1914? Because I'm told that the very first time they used the locks on the opening day of the canal, they worked perfectly. Mm-hmm. So what powers them?
This was one of the first projects that made General Electric what it is today. General Electric was a small, little-known company until they became the prime supplier of this equipment to the canal.
And now they make refrigerators. So they were electrically powered?
Exactly.
And, but mechanically operated?
All mechanical. All mechanical.
Yeah, I mean, they range between 68 and 82 feet, I think. Does that sound right?
That's about right.
This was, I keep calling this one of the seven wonders of the modern world, but when it was opened, it was considered the eighth wonder of the world. I guess there have been six other wonders since then, and that's become part of the modern world. Now that we have a 100-year distance from the opening of the canal, put it into perspective today. Is it still as amazing and such a marvel as it was in 1914, in 2014?
I think it is. You have to tip your hat to all the people who constructed that canal. In fact, a month ago, I went to a memorial service for all of the people who were killed during the construction of the canal. So, American, French, all of the tens of thousands of laborers who came from the Caribbean, Panamanians. You have to honor all of them who gave their lives.
There were tens of thousands of people who died in the construction of this canal.
Yes.
Did most of them die because of disease? Because the French thought that this, what was killing them was the fumes from rotting vegetation and not from mosquitoes. But did most of them die from disease, or did they die because of accidents in the construction? Because there were all kinds of mudslides that buried people alive, etc. How did they die, most of them?
There were lots of industrial accidents, but disease was the main culprit.
So how did they recruit people to come and build this thing when three out of four were dying? How did they get new people to come in and fill the ranks? They advertise in the New York Times. What do they do? How did they get them?
Well, actually, as I understand it, during the French attempt to build the canal, a lot of the laborers came from what is now Jamaica. And because the mortality rate was so high, when they went to recruit workers for the American effort, most of them did not come from Jamaica but came from Barbados and other islands.
Is this any of this addressed in the artwork in this exhibit, or is the artwork pretty much devoted to the amazing technological advancement of this?
It skews in that direction, certainly. Yeah, it's. I think it takes a more celebratory view and a view really of just kind of showing potential viewers what all this looked like.
Are the people in the paintings mostly white people? Or because of the great contingent of people from Jamaica, are they
when
of
you,
African?
When you can make them out, it varies. I mean, the tourists are going to be primarily white. But honestly, one of the challenges for the artists was to communicate the scale of it. So oftentimes the people are mere blips compared to the surroundings. And that's, you know, the scale we get at. We're talking about the size of the lock gates. How do you... The artists were trying to communicate what it was like to be there. I think it must have been pretty overwhelming, and that's the challenge, partly of what we wanted to communicate in the exhibition as well, which is, we thought, how do we have these beautiful paintings and these great prints and all this other material. How do we communicate the scale, which was partly what led us to look for something like that steam shovel bucket? I mean, that there's no better way. When you walk into that exhibition and you see that 6,000-pound steam shovel bucket sitting there, It helps bring it home a little bit.
Well, let's talk about that. I want to know why the whole steam shovel's not here, but that's another story. Danny Martin is with us from the Nederland Mining Museum in Nederland, Colorado?
That's correct.
Where is Nederland, Colorado?
Nederland, Colorado basically sits about 20 miles dead west of Boulder, Colorado, high in the Rocky Mountains.
They're 9,000 feet elevation.
That's correct.
Is the air too thick for you here?
Yes. I sleep very well here.
So you have lent the Mint this part of this steam shovel that you were responsible for gaining for your city and for your museum. How did the Mint discover the shovel and the bucket that's on display at the Mint Museum?
One day I looked at my email and I saw a message from the Mint Museum. I'm constantly getting inquiries about the shovel from all over the world. And I said, oh, well, here's another email. And I didn't even bother to read it until the next morning. And when I saw Jonathan's email to us, I was actually shocked. What would the Mint Museum in Charlotte, North Carolina, be interested in our Panama Canal 50B steam shovel? And then I read a little bit further, and as we're talking here about the 100th year anniversary of the opening of the Panama Canal, I was just enthralled and shocked that someone would be interested, you know, in a piece of our steam shovel and to put it on display.
How did you find out about it at the Mint?
The wonders of the internet, right? it's funny. As I got this idea of trying to communicate the scale of everything. And I think if you come to a lot of the shows I organize, I always try to include bits of ephemera that relate to the works of art in the show. I think it provides a great window of opportunity for our visitors to be able to find other points of access to the works of art in the show, to make maybe personal connections of different kinds that just having the paintings themselves doesn't. And so I was thinking about how we could do this with the Panama Canal show. And as visitors go through, they'll see different kinds of ephemera, like those playing cards that you mentioned, or stereoscopic views, or Joseph Pennell's book, things like that. And so I think moving from that to this idea of scale, and there are graphics in the exhibition that kind of try to communicate the scale as well with maps and comparative illustrations and other things. And I'd seen in an exhibition, 1999, I think, the Smithsonian Museum did a show on the canal, and there had been a different steam shovel bucket in that show, and I thought, what a great thing to do. And so I just started looking on the internet and found all kinds of fun things like steam-powered enthusiast forums, and eventually found my way to their museum.
Well, there was a national television show that documented the move of this steam shovel that you have from the town of Rollinsville in Colorado to your museum, which is about 10 miles away. And the TV show was made in part because it was just moving it that far was a tremendous undertaking. And now you've shipped the bucket of the shovel east of the Mint. There was some question, I understand, about whether or not you could even do that because you had to calculate the weight of the bucket so that it could fit and be raised by the elevator in your museum, which has a limited capacity. Or is it your museum?
Yes, your bucket sits outside.
That's correct. Right?
Yeah. We have the challenge of moving it from eight stories underground up into the fourth floor of our building. And so our freight elevator has a 20,000-pound capacity, so it was good. But then we had to consult structural engineers to get it in there.
We have to stop. We'll come back with more of this tale in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Alpine Ski Center, outfitting skiers and snowboarders since 1976. Charlotte's annual season kickoff event this weekend, 2015 Performance Winter Clothing and Snow Sports Gear, also in Greenville and Banner Elk. And the Carolina Renaissance Festival, a storybook village and artisan marketplace with feasting, jousting, and entertainment for all ages. Saturdays and Sundays, now through November 23rd, renfestinfo.com. Well, a new study says that bike traffic deaths have spiked after years of decline. As cities adapt to growing numbers of cyclists, some say traffic laws should be more strictly enforced. So Diane Rehm and her guests will take a look at the debate over sharing the roads with bikes coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. Coming right back.
The economy, jobs, immigration, the U.S. response to ISIS, all issues on voters' minds in this year's election. On November 4th, the voters weigh in. Your choices will determine who controls the next Congress. I'm Melissa Block. Join us Tuesday for results and analysis from across the country. Special coverage of election night from NPR News.
Listen for national, state, and local election results Tuesday evening beginning at 8 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Panama Canal and specifically about the Mint Museum's new exhibit, which opens on Saturday and runs through February 1st at the uptown location of the Mint, connecting the world, the Panama Canal at 100. Dr. Jonathan Stuhlman is with us. He's the senior curator of the Mint for Modern Contemporary and American Art and the person responsible for curating this exhibit. Danny Martin joins us from the Nederland Mining Museum out in Nederland, Colorado. If you're ever out there and you're interested in old mining equipment and big infrastructure building equipment, they've got it galore evidently out there. And Jonathan Farrar is with us. He's the U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Panama. Kevin on Twitter reminded us of a well-known palindrome: a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. All right. Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate that. Any more things you want to tweet us, feel free to do so. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, and you can find us on Facebook as well. I read a newspaper article from Nederland, Colorado, that talked about the removal of this shovel from your steam shovel and its trip east. It kind of turned some heads, I'm told.
Yes. This is very unusual to see something like this antique piece of equipment being removed. The bucket had not been removed, I believe, since 1949. And I had questions myself if this was going to be something that was easily removed.
Or easily put back together.
Yeah, correct. And it was quite the process. Of course, being a cable excavator, we had to cut the cable from the main pulley that lifts the bucket, which is an inch and a half steel cable.
And was that cable, did that cable date back to 1949 or 1923?
I believe that probably was the original cable that was on
and
it.
And you had to cut it?
Yes. Yep.
Does that bother you as a person who values historical artifacts? I mean, that must have hurt.
Yeah, well, we operate the shovel usually on a monthly basis in the summer.
Still operational?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. And the cable itself was quite worn out, so it's something, you know, just for safety reasons, right, that needed to be replaced. So it didn't break my heart to cut it.
So you shipped it across the country. How big is the bucket that we're talking? Because people think, oh, I've seen people digging up the road out front with a modern day shovel. What's the big deal? How big is the bucket on this shovel?
The bucket's about the size of a small tough shed. So basically, I'd say about 4.5 feet wide by, I believe it's 5 or 6 feet tall, by about 4 feet deep. But the bucket itself is made out of high tensile strength steel, mm-hmm, because this is sort of the business end of the steam shovel, and it has to deal with all the rock. And those shovel buckets are specially made. The tensile strength of the bucket is about 100,000 PSI. Wow. As far as its hardness, because it's always rubbing up against rock, and it has 27-inch ripping teeth to dig into solid bedrock.
That's 2 feet.
Yes, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Wow. From Juan, we have a couple of emails that have come in from Juan. Great show, as opposed to the natural progression that the ambassador suggested. Part of the reason why the U.S. eventually turned over the canal to the Panamanians has to do with the Mardi's Day massacre in January of 1964, when Panamanian high school students tried to hoist their national flag along with the U.S. and were met with bullets. It was a national loss of innocence on the part of many Panamanians and Latin Americans alike. I'm not familiar with this at all. Are you?
I am. In fact, this January was the 50th anniversary of that, and I attended the memorial service for people.
So the United States fired on high school students in Panama trying to raise a flag?
This was Canal Zone police at the time, yes.
Wow.
So there were several dozen casualties that day, both American and Panamanian.
From Janet, my grandmother was assigned to work in the Canal Zone as it was being built as part of government nursing staff. My grandfather worked for a mining company, and he was going to Colombia to conduct assessments for his employer. He evidently stopped off in the zone, met my grandmother. On his way back from his assignment, he stopped again in the zone to see her. At the conclusion of her commitment, she left to marry my grandfather, and they headed to Alaska to continue their very adventurous lives. Wow. Alex, on Facebook, the Nicaraguan Canal's construction work is expected to start in December 2014 and will be completed within 5 years by China. Do you think the Panama Canal's income will suffer significantly because of this completion?
I think the Panama Canal's completion will – the expansion is slated to be done by early 2016.
And that's about a year after the expanded canal, the expanded Panama Canal will be operational.
No, the expanded Panama Canal will be should open in early 2016.
Oh, I'm sorry, okay.
So the plans for Nicaragua, I think Panama and others are looking to see if that comes to fruition and how long it takes to construct that, mm-hmm. which would require excavating much more earth than has ever been excavated in Panama.
Okay. Adrian, please ask about gold roll versus silver roll distinctions during the Panama construction. I don't know anything about this. I hope you do.
During the operation of the canal, there were, back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, there were two rolls for workers, the gold roll and the silver roll. And the workers were paid on different scales, according to which roll you were on.
And how did you get on those? Did you choose to be on those roles, or did somebody choose for you?
That was an aspect of segregation back in those days.
Mm. Mm. Anne in Denver, that's our Denver, by the way, not yours, writes, unfortunately, little is known about the engineer who was instrumental in the completion of the canal. My mother was a friend of his granddaughter, Ginny Hawks, married to relative of film director Howard Hawks. Ginny loaned my mother many papers of John Stevens, and she became very interested in his accomplishments. She and my father traveled to the Northwest to see another of his engineering feats and visited a place where there is a statue in his honor. My mother also talked to David McCullough about writing a biography. He is mentioned in McCullough's Path Between the Seas. Talk about the people who actually built this thing. There's John Stevens, and there's another fellow who came down, I believe, and really orchestrated making it happen. He may not have been the person who designed it, but he made sure all the work he oversaw the project. Talk about these people, because it's a this is before we don't understand. This is before computers. They had to do this on paper. I'll bring you into this, Danny, because you understand machinery and you understand how these things work. This must have been an incredible undertaking.
Absolutely. It was the first time in the history of the world something like this was even attempted.
Well, the Suez Canal had been built, correct?
Yes, but not at – that's correct, but something at this scale was unheard of. Mm-hmm. And they had speculated about it for years that could it ever really be built.
Yeah.
And – you know, with modern machinery of the time, of course, the steam shovel and steam locomotives, they thought that, yes, this could possibly be done. But, you know, going down into the middle of a jungle and operating large machinery like that and dealing with all of the horrible conditions, I can sort of speak from a steam shovel aspect. The operators, to operate a steam shovel, you need 3 to 4 people just inside it. You have a fireman who has to sort of keep the boiler stoked. Now, you have to imagine you're down in Panama. It's already 100 degrees, 100% humidity. The temperature inside the steam shovels raised up to about 140 degrees for a fireman that was stoking the fire constantly. Mm. They actually worked in their underwear. and they would have buckets of water inside these shovels, just pouring the water on them just to try to keep the temperature down. And you can imagine this heat just radiating. Everything was metal on those shovels. And if you look at some of the pictures that of these shovels, you can see all the panels are removed on the shovel. Most of the shovels, when they came from the factory, were totally enclosed, two-thirds of them. And they would remove the panels just so the heat could
dissipate
from them. That's correct. And then they had to deal with all of these massive slides, especially in the Culebra Cut. There was a section that gave way at one time. I believe it was 75 acres at one time let loose and totally breached the entire other side. And it took them, I believe, a third of a year just to remove the actual slide itself. It set them back. They just unbelievable, and it would rain constantly there in the wet season.
Where did they put all the dirt?
The dirt had to be all hauled out by railroad cars, and this was one of the advances where the French were dumping it close to where they were excavating it, and the Americans would take it all the way out away from the excavation and just use it to build roads and create fill areas around the locks. They used it in all different areas.
Ambassador, you are in Charlotte not only for the opening of this exhibit, but to take part in the U.S. Export Council Discover Global Markets Conference, which is in town. And I suppose it's in town because of the Mint Museum. I'm not sure. The canal is about to expand. We've done a whole show on this in the past because of our intermodal transportation facility at the airport. It's going to be widened. It will accommodate substantially larger ships, and the hope is that these larger ships will then take advantage of southern ports and then our intermodal facility. What impact is that likely to have on the U.S. economy, on the global economy?
Mm-hmm. Sure. First of all, I should say that trade between the United States and Panama is a good news story. The United States has a $10 billion trade surplus with Panama because Panama is a great market for U.S. products and services.
What are they buying from us?
They're buying agricultural products. They're buying processed food products. They're buying telecommunications equipment, you name it, pharmaceuticals.
Okay.
Yeah. But the expansion of the canal will mean there's a race going on now among seaports along the U.S. Gulf Coast and East Coast to expand their own facilities to be able to handle these larger ships that are going to be coming through the canal. And there'll be winners in that race, and there'll be some that are left behind. So it's incumbent upon these ports to work as quickly as possible to be ready to handle these ships.
Now, we did a whole program on this because it's difficult for some people to understand how this could possibly help Charlotte because these ships are not coming to Charlotte. These ships are coming to Wilmington and Charleston, maybe Norfolk and places like that. But the idea here is that the cargo on these massive ships that have come to this widely expanded canal will be offloaded, put on rail cars, and shipped through Charlotte and distributed because we are within 100, I don't know what it is, half, almost most of the population lives within a day's railroad trip from Charlotte. Do you think unequivocally that we will benefit in Charlotte from this expanded canal?
I think it will be a competition. And Charlotte has to compete. And I say that as someone who was born and raised in Los Angeles, California, and whose father worked in the port of Los Angeles and Long Beach for 25 years. That's the port that faces the challenge of being able to compete with these expanded ports on the Gulf Coast and East Coast. Mm-hmm. Because right now, a lot of the ships that are too big to go through the canal stop in L.A. and offload there. Mm-hmm. So it's all a competition. And Charlotte has to compete for that trade.
Well, I know that I've forgotten the country in South America that lost business because of the canal, because ships didn't stop there anymore when the canal first opened. Will the Port of Los Angeles lose business now because they won't have to offload these enormous ships in L.A. and ship them across the country? They can come to Wilmington and distribute through Charlotte?
It'll be possible. It's all a question of price. And whether it's cheaper for the large ships to go through the canal and offload here versus offloading in Los Angeles and moving by rail across the U.S.
Now, this exhibit at the Mint begins with a piece that was commissioned, I believe, by the Mint Museum of artist Mel Chin.
Yes.
Called Sea, S-E-A, yes. To Sea, S-E-E.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Well, Mel, we decided to work with him in order to celebrate, partly to celebrate the centennial of the canal. I thought, centennials are a great time to reflect on the past, but also look ahead to the future. And so we wanted to do something, to commission some new things by artists that would help to inspire those thoughts. And so we were looking for ways to do that. And one of them was through the commission of a new work of art. Now, Mel's an artist that I've known for almost 15, 20 years, and worked with him prior to coming to Charlotte, and was aware that he actually lives out in Burnsville, North Carolina. And so since I've been here, I've been looking for an opportunity to do something with him. A lot of his work focuses in very innovative and very collaborative ways on looking back at different historical events and also looking at kind of environmental concerns and other ideas like that. And so I had to kind of developed a short list of artists I wanted to approach for the commission. And I realized, well, it's Mel. I'm going to go to Mel first. And he'd just been a resident over at the McCall Center. Mm-hmm. Went over to his studio and chatted with him and just pitched the idea. What would you like to do? Would you be interested in this? And we talked about the canal as this point of connection, not only between different countries and different people of the world, but also between the oceans. And so he came up with this idea of creating two 12-foot-high plate glass hemispheres that would be facing each other, and people would walk between them, kind of replicating the passage
through the canal,
and also of kind of the canal itself is positioned between the oceans. And they serve as projection screens for films that are created from scientific data over the past 100 years on the Atlantic and Pacific oceans. And so that and other parts of the show, I wanted to take a moment to thank our sponsors. That project in particular was sponsored by the Knight Foundation and other sponsors, Wells Fargo, the lead exhibition sponsor, the Duke Energy Foundation, and the Horowitz Foundation, among others, all work together to make things like this possible.
That is Dr. Jonathan Stuhlman, who's the senior curator at the Mint Museum. The exhibit is called Connecting the World, the Panama Canal at 100. It opens on Saturday, runs through February 1st. Also want to thank Danny Martin with the Netherlands Mining Museum for lending us the shovel bucket, and Jonathan Farrar, U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Panama.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.